welcome to another edition of the Armchair Directors. For each episode, we take a look at one of cinema's great directors and their essential films. This week on the show, we are looking at director Akira Kurosawa and his 1950 film, Rashomon. Returning on the show today to talk about Rashomon is Professor Marie Westhaver. Professor Westhaver, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
So this is like probably the essential Kurosawa, because remember we were talking last time we talked about a Kurosawa film was One Wonderful Sunday, and this was just like 2-3 years before this movie came out, and we talked about One Wonderful Sunday. We were kind of talking about this is still kind of early in his career, he's still trying to get the hang of things. Like I said, like that ending where they're literally pleading with the audience, breaking the fourth wall to stand up and applaud, really kind of really just sort of like not good for me. But like right here, Rashomon is really kind of, Once he does that, he's just hitting home run after home run after home run for me.
Yeah, I think Rashomon is part of a trilogy that I think is like the essential Kurosawa, which is Ikuru, Rashomon, mm-hmm. and The Seven Samurai.
Yeah, definitely. And this is like one of those films, like I remember a long time ago I talked with Giuliano about Battleship Potemkin. This is like one of those films I think like I have a fifth theory that like every intro to film class in America is going to teach is like going to include this movie.
You know, there's so much to cover in intro to film. I don't get to this movie at all.
You're proving my theory wrong.
But, however, I use it every time I teach film and philosophy, where we talk about what is truth and how do you know that what you know is what you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and like you said, this is, I mean, I imagine, you know what, changed my mind. Like, I just recently watched The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, so this makes me wrong, but this is one of the, this is definitely one of the more earlier films that showcase unreliable narrators.
That's right. Although in the German movies, that was meant to be a twist at the end, which was new
with a twist
to them. With a twist.
But yeah, in this film, you get like three unreliable narrators, and it's almost left up to the audience to, well, what's really true and what isn't? I mean, at the end of the film, you're pretty much, it's implied that the woodcutter's story is true, that he's the one that's the most honest out of all of them. But then again, he's sort of implied that he did something bad at the end. So, you know, is his story entirely true, or is he just making himself look good? So at the end, you don't really know what exactly is the truth. What was the entire truth of what went down that day?
I always thought the movie was about like the game of telephone. Like if when you repeat a story, it changes. And I always thought it was about everyone having their own take on the truth. But, you know, I've done some reading about the movie and the intent behind the movie. And Kurosawa thought it was more about how no one is a good narrator. We're all compelled to embellish our own stories to make ourselves look better. Mm-hmm. So his idea was that this was about the quicksand of ego, how you're never going to get a real answer out of anybody because they've got to make themselves sound and look good.
Yeah, and
which is why I think the woodcutter is the most believable, because he sounds the worst in his retelling.
Yeah, and like you said, with the unreliable narrator, and even one of the things I noticed in the film was, you notice how the sunlight shining through, but it's always getting obscured by the trees and everything. I thought that was interesting, the way that the truth in this movie is getting obscured. I think that was definitely an intentional choice by Kurosawa and the DP.
Well, I love the way it opens with that ruined gate, which is actually what it's named for, Rashomon, and the, rain coming down really hard. And then by the very end, the sun peaks out a little bit. So it's a bracketing kind of a thing where he lets you know at the beginning that something very dark and sinister is happening. They had some trouble getting the effects that they wanted because that rain just wasn't showing up against the light gray background. So they put ink in the rain machine to make it come out black. And you can actually see it a little bit on the woodcutter's face right before it stops raining. They also took some mirrors into the forest to bounce the light because that just wasn't getting the look that he wanted. So there's all kinds of tricky things he did for the first time that nobody had tried before, lots of handheld camera work and things like that. But the play of light is very, I think, magical in the way he shot this film.
Yeah, and like even you were talking earlier about the rain and the sunlight, it's once again kind of that element of Kurosawa, where he's always talking about, you know, the weather is always playing everything. There are movies like in Seven Samurai or something where there's just this torrential downpour. There's a movie he did called Stray Dog where it's this, you know, they're trying to solve a crime amidst this unbearable heat wave.
You know, sometimes there's snow. There's snow. Likes to use weather.
He likes to use
mood.
Weather. Like Yojimbo, when it's the final showdown, there's all this wind everywhere, and there's even a tumbleweed because that cliche, but, you know.
Yeah, he likes to use weather as a mood setter, especially rain. He does like rain.
And it's like interesting is you talked about with, you know, the way it was shot and all the different things. Also, it's the way it's edited because it's very tightly edited. Like all the when it's you're focusing on the story with when it's editing between all the three characters and they're almost in the same like close ups. It's sort of highlighting that like triangular relation that they have, that they're all because of what happened, that they're going to be connected. And you can tell that through the editing.
Good point. It is tightly edited. You are right.
Yeah. And
oh, one of the things to know, though, with all that rain is that they kept having slugs fall on them out of the trees. So they would slather themselves with salt. I know. Yeah, you can't tell by looking at it. It looks very, it looks rainy, but it doesn't look sticky. You know, none of the characters are wet.
Oh, okay, yeah. You know, like you said, even with the elements, you know, what we talked about with the sunlight, where it's obscured throughout with the trees when the story is being told three different times. And then, like you said, it's the rain when the people in the area are retelling the stories. And at the very end, like you said, once the rain stopped and, you know, the woodcutter and the priest have sort of, gained a respect of each other, I guess. It's sunlight. It's coming through. Everything's being set. It's like the truth is setting you free. Which, once again, I feel that maybe the woodcutter is telling the truth.
You know, the whole idea of having a narrator is very Japanese because, and I know you wanted to talk about how it was very much like silent film. Mm-hmm. When the Japanese were making silent films, they would have a narrator come out. It's someone called a Benshi. And while the movie was on, he would narrate what was going on. And now we see on the screen, blah, blah, blah. Hmm. Kurosawa's older brother did this as for a living.
Wow.
And he looked up to his brother very much. In fact, that's why he got into film in the first place. So anytime you have a narrator who suddenly appears where it seems unusual for us, like in One Wonderful Sunday, mm-hmm. when she's looking
get
at
up
the
and
camera.
Cheer.
I mean, for us, that did look seem very awkward, but I think it probably mm-hmm. felt more correct in a Japanese theater because they thought, yeah, someone addressing the camera and telling us what we're supposed to be thinking, that's very much in keeping with early mm-hmm. Japanese film.
I'm going to make a hell of a segue here, but
okay.
You know, the way that, like you said, like they have like somebody kind of narrating the story and what's telling you what's going on in the movie, that's very similar to what's going on in Uganda as Ugandan cinema, because there's this very big famous film called Who Killed Captain Alex?
Yes.
It's this big action movie. It was made for like $200. But anyway, like when all the action's going on, they have this guy called a video joker, and he's sort of telling you what kind of like an Mystery Science Theater thing where he's telling you what's going on in the story, but he's also making a lot of jokes and just like even just saying random things or whatever pops in his head. Like there's a shot of like all these like pelicans or something on a beach, and then he says dinosaurs. And then like whenever there's like action going on, he goes, the movie is on, movie, 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 movie. And he's just, but he's actually not even like I watched a little documentary about that because he's works for a company called Wakaliwood. They make this in Uganda. It's in this more in poverty areas of Uganda, and so they have these movie halls, and they kind of, you know, one side is like a kind of a sports bar where you want to watch like the soccer game or whatever, you can go there. But the other side, if you want to watch a movie, you can go there, and they project it. And this video joker guy is in there, and he's narrating it. Because I guess there's also kind of a language barrier in Uganda. Like some people speak one language and some people speak the other, and he can speak both. So one side is like, and, you know, we'll say this happening in this language, and then this happening is in this language.
Hmm.
And so while he's doing that, he's also making a lot of wisecracks, you know. No, Ugandan cinema, greatest movie ever made, Who Killed Captain Alex? And it's great. You got to watch it. It's on YouTube. It's completely legal to watch for free. And definitely recommend. So that was a hell of a segue, wasn't it, from Ugandan cinema to Akira Kurosawa.
You know what that makes me think of, though, in terms of like modern day? The closest I can think of would be a drive-in theater. Like if you go to the Benji's, in between each movie, he sets it up and tells you some sort of joke or tells you how much time you have to go spend more money at the snack bar. But that running patter is like having a DJ. You know, so before each thing comes up, you know, somebody comes in to sort of remind you that it's time for the movie or the movie just ended. And I think that's the only time we see that in the theater, going to the movies.
Yeah.
Having a narrator of sorts.
Never thought I would reference Who Killed Captain Alex in a movie, in a discussion about Rashomon, but here I did. But going back to what you were saying, how it's almost like a silent film, I think that's one thing we could really talk about is because Japan kind of stayed with silent films a lot longer than we did. Once like 1930 hit, we were pretty much, everything was a talkie. But like in Japan, they were a little bit slower. Like it took them, it wasn't until like mid-30s that they started having talkies. Because you even see like Kurosawa didn't start directing until the early 40s, but like early Ozu films, a lot of those were silent. So they really stayed, so that's why it's sort of like, it's more recent. Like they just started doing talkies for like 15 years or so. That's still more recent and it's still more entrenched in their film culture.
Yeah. And for them, the idea that sound went with the movie was something new. It wouldn't have to be that way. You wouldn't have to have the sound of somebody speaking following their voice or a sound effect, because they were used to something happening on the screen and then the Benshi telling them what was going on. So for them, sound and vision or visuals didn't go together. It took a long time for them to get there.
Yeah,
and they liked it like that.
Yeah, and even in this movie, like, there's not a lot of dialogue. I mean, that even when they're setting up the whole story, the one everybody can agree on what started it, and before they go into like, well, how did it end? Like, you know, we hear a lot of the music. We see the husband and wife walking through the area in the forest. We see Toshiro Mifune kind of stalking them, and we get this kind of very loud, aggressive music playing, and that goes on for a while. And while that's going on, there's hardly any narration or anything going on as far as dialogue.
The music is Bolero,
yeah,
which is so bizarre. It seems so over the top, but then so does a lot of the things about the movie. It feels very melodramatic, especially Mifune and that crazy laugh.
Yeah, and this is like, when we talk about how I talk about this is a Kurosawa becoming Kurosawa, this is like the biggest early hit, probably the movie that made Mifune. Before this, he did a couple other films with Kurosawa. One was Drunken Angel and Stray Dog, and those are good movies. But like this is the film where you really kind of get to see Mifune. I mean, Mifune being Mifune, like you said, with the you know, which he does like in a lot of movies, like you watch Yojimbo or Sanjuro, Hidden Fortress. You know, Throne of Blood, he kind of has it is with a very deep laugh.
Well, you know, for this movie, Kurosawa told him to study wild animals, particularly lions. So he's trying to imitate the way lions move.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, you know, like you said, the way it's melodramatic, because, like, you see, like, the first two versions, mainly Mifune's character and the husband, the way they talk about the fight. It's this big romantic, you know, like something out of an Errol Flynn movie with clashing of swords and everything. And then when you get to the woodcutter story of what the fight really was, it's so embarrassing and awkward to watch. There's just a lot of like, you know, he tries to lunge and then the other guy backs back. They're almost scared to fight. And when they fight, they just like tumble around. And it looks like, you know, like a schoolyard
like
fight.
Like a girl fight. Like
yeah,
you're waiting
for
them to pull each other's hair.
It's not this manly, valor, romantic fight of clashing swords and the toughest one wins. It's just sort of awkward and uncomfortable to watch, is probably what a lot of what happened with a lot of people got into fights.
The sequence with the wife, though, she really wields that blade with some authority. She doesn't hold back.
Yeah, and it's in the way even the wife is sort of where how, you know, the husband treats her, and then the way the bandit treats her. And then the way, you know, they sort of always look down on her. And at the end, what really happens in the story, she's the one that basically says, you know, you men are too cowards to fight for my love, so you need to fight. So she's the one that really spurs them into the whole thing.
Yeah. Which is sort of unexpected. You know what else is unexpected? This is something I tell my students in all my classes. In most Asian films, but certainly in Japanese films, you never ever see people kissing because it's considered gross. Like, why would you put that in there? Kind of gross. Like, no one needs to see that. We know what people do, but it's just not done. But it's done in this because there's an attack on this woman.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, it's like the one time you're going to see people kissing in a Japanese movie, it's an assault.
It's not romantic.
It's not romantic.
Yeah, and that's the, so this was 1950. Were we out of Japan by that time? So did we not, they have to worry about our censorship of movies? Because I know, like, when you watch...
We were still occupying, I believe.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and I think that's, like, one of the underlying themes is that the husband is supposed to be, like, old Japan. The tradition, the culture of royalty, I guess, or being well born, and then the bandit and the woodcutter represent the younger generation. There's a whole lot of philosophical theses going on.
And it's
about
interesting.
That.
I honestly didn't quite get that. Do you care to elaborate just a little bit on that?
Look at my notes. It wasn't something I came up with. It was something that I was reading as a analysis of why they made it the way it was. I do want to say, though, that this movie did not do well in Japan, Rashomon.
It doesn't surprise me because it's kind of the thing about Kurosawa. He was big in everywhere except Japan.
In fact, Kurosawa didn't even think it was any good. They reluctantly entered it into the Venice Film Festival where it won the grand prize. And they were all surprised. But it does represent the opening to the west of Japanese movies. But there was a whole treatise on it. It was very brief, but they were very definite about the fact that it was meant to represent old and new world and the oppression of having the enemy, us, the U.S., still being like in the perimeter. I don't know. Sometimes when you go into a lot of film criticism, people do some stretching. But this was done by a famous psychologist named Robin Wood, who went into the whole moral dimension of the movie. And
this movie's got nothing on The Shining for as much as theory stretching. But yeah, I can kind of, I have, looking at my notes, a couple of people have written that this is an allegory for Japan's defeat in World War II, where maybe I can see where it wasn't like this. Because, you know, this honorable defeat in a lot of Japan's eyes, if they were beaten. You had the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. At the end, the army was just brown beaten. Think what happened in Iwo Jima. And it was just a total defeat. And, like, at that time, they viewed, you know, defeat and surrender as something completely dishonorable and horrible. So I can kind of see how maybe this would be a, you know, allegory for the defeat of World War II.
And when you think about the opening, you know, the beating rain, the black rain, and this destroyed, very ornate gate, that does look sort of like the destruction of the old ways. The door is actually damaged.
Yeah. It's almost like a bombed out shelter, like something we saw in One Wonderful Sunday as they're touring Japan. I mean,
he spent almost all of his budget just building that gate.
Wow.
Yeah, he was obsessed with that gate. And then at the end, the sun starts to come out, and you start to think, well, maybe there's hope.
Yeah, because the ending scene is the thing is they find a kid, and the woodcutter takes the kid home. And the priest refuses to let him touch the kid because, like, he's going to, I forget what he thinks he's going to do. He's going to, like, sell the kid or do something bad. I forget. And he goes, no. It's like, I already have a bunch of kids. One isn't going to change much. And I'll be more than happy to take him in. And I think the priest slowly kind of sees that this guy is a good guy. He's not like, you know, like the three people in the story. He is a good person. And the priest says, you know, you've restored my faith in humanity.
Now, this may be a bit of a stretch, but I can't help but wonder if this borrows a little bit from Snow White, because it was the woodcutter who went out to save her, and he killed a deer or something and brought that heart back to the evil witch, just because it's the woodcutter in the woods and then he saves the child at the end.
It is very fairy tale-ish, because it is set, I would say, like the Middle Ages. I don't know what exactly it's set, but, you know, not modern times. And, like, even, like, that one of the shots that stick out to me, it's almost when Mifune first sees them. And the way that horse carriage is like the sunlight is shining right through the horse carriage, that feels like something out of a fairy tale, because he sees this woman as like this majestic creature or something that he must have and ravish. Mm-hmm. You know, something like a something that sounds like something out of like an old myth or a fairy tale, a creepy myth or fairy tale.
Yeah, the untold story. Mm-hmm. Yes, what happened while Red Riding Hood was on her way to the see the wolf or something.
Yeah.
And the blinding light also. This was apparently the first time anyone actually pointed a camera directly at the sun.
Interesting.
And he used the light as another metaphor for being, you know, blinded by your own pride or blinded by your inability to see beyond your own self.
Yeah. They're blind to see what was actually true. Like
right.
You said, like, he's got to, you know, the bandit, Toshiro Mifune, he's got to be, he sets himself as this romantic figure, you know. He's a womanizer. He wins her, basically, you know, and he wins in a fair fight against the husband to win her over. And so everything he does is honorable in his eye. He's blind to see that he's horrible. Same thing with the husband. Same thing with the wife.
Mm-hmm. Same thing with the woodcutter.
Same thing with the woodcutter, too.
Yeah. And also the idea of vision obscured, because sometimes the light is dappling, you know, you see a little, and the wife is actually blinded temporarily by the sun, which causes her to mm-hmm. succumb to what happens to her. But it's just this whole idea of the limits of human perspective and how much light is literally shedding on something.
Mm-hmm. I don't have it written down in here, but one part I want to get to is one of the little problems I have with this film is the part where they're telling the husband's story and it's told through a medium.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't, once again, this is kind of, this is set in like the Middle Ages or something with Japanese culture. So I'm not an expert on that. So maybe this was like an accepted, you know, this was considered common or accepted to have mediums. And if that's so, I'll shut up and I'll let it go. But like, it does seem a little bit strange. Like, oh, we're bringing, like, this is a movie like about this crime. How did it happen? Now let's bring this paranormal thing of a medium bringing about the spirit of the dead husband. I thought that part was a little bit, I guess, silly.
Yeah, I think it's because it's an Eastern idea. I mean, in the first place, I think this is not, and I didn't make a list or anything, but I know Kurosawa has used other characters in the past who straddle two worlds. But also, I think this is the Benshi coming back. This is the narrator. This is the third party who's able to say, well, let me tell you what happened. On the screen, you'll see blah, blah, blah happening. And so you have someone explain it. So I think it's just very Japanese.
And it kind of almost even goes back to the whole thing where, remember, if like a person just before they're about to die says, this person killed me, that's taken as word and that person will be taken in for the murder, even if that person's saying that just to get back at somebody. Yes, maybe it's even kind of like that where he's know in his position that he's a dead man, that his word will be taken in because he's the one who's the total victim of the crime.
Right, mm-hmm. Yeah. It is interesting that there's like only three different sets. One is at the gate, the people mm-hmm. talking at the gate. There is the trial where you never see the judge. And then there's us as the audience actually witnessing what's going on, maybe, because you get a couple of different viewpoints.
Yeah.
So there's Forrest, the courtyard, and the gate.
And what's interesting is that you never, when they're addressing the judge or who's ever overseeing the proceedings, you never see them. They're always looking mm-hmm. right at the camera. It's almost like you're the judge. It almost made me think a little bit of like Charlie Brown. You know, it's like I was
wah,
waiting for someone
wah,
to go, wah, 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 wah. But, and it was interesting, like you said, this film bombed in Japan, and they were completely surprised that it was big anywhere. That kind of goes to Kurosawa's whole career. He was big everywhere except his native country, Japan. But you can really see the legacy of this film. Two films that always come to mind immediately, well, one film that comes to mind immediately when I think of this film is The Usual Suspects. And, you know, spoiler alert for a movie that's almost 20 years old, but that movie is all about unreliable narrator, and it gives you that big twist ending mm-hmm. at the end. There was another film called Vantage Point with Dennis Quaid, where it's about, I haven't seen it, but it's like a presidential assassination, and everybody who was there gives their side of the story as what happened and how it went down. And the more and more people give the story, the less makes sense. And there was
Courage Under Fire.
Courage Under Fire. There was this kids movie called Hoodwinked from like 2006. Okay, you've seen it? Yeah. So there's a bunch of them. Like you said, it's the Rashomon effect. Like this is like a movie that even if you haven't seen it, you can kind of understand. You can see the influence in so many movies.
Well, even on The Simpsons. I mean, they even did a Rashomon thing where I think they're on the plane going to Japan and Homer doesn't like it. And Marge says, oh, come on, Homer. You liked Rashomon? And he says, that's not how I remember it.
Yeah. It's a classic Simpsons joke.
That is a classic Simpsons. There's so many classic Simpsons jokes. But yeah, the whole idea of Rashomon being, it's almost a way to say there's more than one way to look at something. I mean, I can't help but think about that with the Kavanaugh hearings.
Exactly.
You know, you have two people telling two completely different stories, and then you're left wondering what to believe, who to believe. And in that case, I think what Kurosawa said is very applicable, that I'm sure both of them embellished their stories to make themselves look better because apparently we cannot help ourselves.
And even then, they were interviewing witnesses, and like some people were saying what she's saying is completely wrong, and then there are other people saying what he's saying is completely wrong. And then you're just kind of, and then once again, the audience or whoever is just sort of left going, well, what really happened?
Right.
Just like in this movie, like what really happened? Is there partial truth to what he's saying, partial truth to what she's saying, partial truth to what the witnesses were backing her up, partial truth to the witnesses what are backing him up? So once again, it kind of leaves into this whole, you're just kind of left scratching your head like, I don't know what really went happened.
Actually, that's one of the reasons why they say it's a good story about an unreliable narrator, because without all of the unreliable narrators, we wouldn't get anywhere at all. I mean, you need some of the truth to get to the truth.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, getting close to the end of my questions. Is there anything about Rashomon or Akira Kurosawa that you want to bring up? There's one other film that I want to bring up. There was a because Kurosawa, whenever his Kurosawa movies get adapted into American films, what did they get adapted into? Westerns. And there was a Western, I'm looking it up, I forgot the name of it. Let me look it up. It was a remake in the 60s, and I believe William Shatner was in it. Yes, I know. I love the look on your face.
Well, while you're looking that up, I'll tell you a couple of things I wanted to say about Mifune. He actually wanted to be a photographer, not an actor, and he got his start in the movies when he blundered into an audition by mistake and flew into a rage. That's how he got started in movies. He was considered for the role of Mr. Miyagi in The Karate Kid. But after the reading, the producers felt that he acted the role too scary.
Yeah. You know what else he was considered for?
What?
Obi-Wan Kenobi.
You know, I almost think he could have pulled that off, but he would have been too tough.
Yeah, he would have been like screaming in Luke's face. And then when he's fighting Vader, he would have just been laughing at him.
See, I could see him doing the Liam Neeson part.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
He has that sort of gravitas.
But even, I can even think of that Tatooine scene in Star Wars when, you know, Obi-Wan whips out the lightsaber and cuts the guy's arm off. That's classic Mifune. Just think of Yojimbo. Like, maybe that would have worked for him.
Not enough you saw, if you've ever seen the Japanese animated series, Speed Racer. But the hero is named Go Mifune as a tribute to him.
Okay, I did find it. It is a 1964 film called The Outrage. Look at this. Here's the cast. Paul Newman, Lawrence Harvey, Claire Bloom, Edward G. Robinson, and William Shatner.
Yeah, I found that and put it in my Netflix queue, thinking, how have I never heard of this before?
And this was directed by Martin Ritt, who directed HUD, The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, and Sounder. So, decent director, too.
Maybe we should take a look at that one
we'll
and compare.
Check that out sometime, yeah. All right, last one. Anything else you want to bring up, or do you want to go just give us a little description of your classes?
Well, let me just say, if you ever hear Mifune doing a movie in English, he doesn't know any English. He just memorizes everything phonetically. He has no idea what he's saying.
Interesting.
I know. It's kind of interesting when you find out little tips like that. In my classes this semester, I teach intro to film, world cinema, American cinema, and film and philosophy, where we do talk about Rashomon.
Okay. Well, that wraps up this episode of The Armchair Director. We have been discussing director Akira Kurosawa and his 1950 film, Rashomon. Don't forget, you can listen to The Armchair Directors every Tuesday at 9:30 a.m., Sunday at 2:30 p.m., or anytime at dragondigitalradio.podbean.com under the category Armchair Directors. Plus, Westhaven, I want to thank you again for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
For The Armchair Directors, I'm your host, Alex Baker, saying it's human to lie. Most of the time, we can't even be honest with ourselves.